Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and this is the series of interviews that goes into depth with the great names of tennis about what got them to the top. Today's subject never did win a Grand Slam title, but he did win an awful lot, including 15 tour-level titles on all surfaces and an Olympic silver medal. But what makes this interview insightful, in part, is that he grew up in Europe and then went to seek his tennis fortune via the tennis academy world in Florida. I'm talking about Tommy Haas.
Yeah, there were days that were tough and you had to train hard. And of course, in order to reach your goals or your potential, anything you do, you're going to have to put in the hard yards. Be thankful for everything you have. You know, it can be taken away from you quickly. A shoulder surgery or two or maybe three mean nothing when you kind of know that it can be much worse. You have to have an incredible self-belief, discipline, work ethic, you know, talent.
In this interview, Tommy talks about how he dealt with being homesick when he first went from Germany to Florida, how he sought to channel what he calls his inner dog to make him a fighter on court, and how his career changed in character from being a gradual rise to number two in the rankings to a tale of persistent comebacks as his shoulder required several operations. Tommy Haas spoke with Chris Bowers.
Tommy, what do you think is the main attribute that makes a champion?
It's a good question. How many attributes do you have to have in order to become a champion, I think, right? I think there is not just one. I think there's a lot of factors that probably play a role in that. And then probably the counter question would be, how do you define a champion? I mean, I think there's a lot of champions amongst us in all walks of life, in all, you know, shapes and sizes. In my world, you know, in the tennis world, let's say, I don't even know if I consider myself a real, real champion because, you know, my goal or my dream would have been to win a Grand Slam, which I didn't. So, you know, if I would have won one, maybe I would tell myself, you are a champion. But I think there's a lot of things, you know, but too hard to answer that because in a specific sort of way of life, right?
Okay, so if there are lots of qualities and attributes that make a champion, is there anything specific that elevates a champion to a Hall of Famer?
Yes, probably. In our sport, I mean, again, I think you have to have an incredible self-belief, discipline, work ethic, you know, talent, and a great team of people around you, hopefully also in the household, in order to become a champion.
The story goes that you started playing with a plank of wood. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah. My dad was a tennis teacher, so, you know, he didn't really have that much time to play with me in the younger years. So I got a little wooden racket and, you know, a couple of tennis balls, and he showed me the way to the tennis wall, and that's kind of how I started.
How old are you?
Young. I probably was like maybe three and a half years old. Apparently, you know, also in the apartment that we lived or that I grew up in, we did that sometimes, you know, in the room where he would throw me a tennis ball and I kind of hit it back pretty much right into his hand all the time. And that's when he told my mother that I think there is something to this. This is pretty crazy that this kid at this age is, you know, making good contact with the ball every time I throw it at him. So maybe in some ways it was sort of meant to be for me to play tennis.
And you won your first junior tournament at five.
Six, I think,
six,
yes.
Okay.
At six, yeah, exactly. The, you know, club sort of championships that I grew up with, that my dad was teaching at. Yes, exactly.
And what age of children were you beating?
I think it was under 10. And I played when I was six, exactly. And they couldn't quite believe that I was, you know, so competitive and didn't really miss much. And for some reason, you know, in the club, I at six was sort of the best under the 10s. I remember actually one situation incredibly well when I think I won it. The opponent that I played, who was 10 at the time, he was at least probably, you know, a head and a half taller than I was. And when he lost, he couldn't really take it. And he ran around the court and left the court and was just screaming in many ways. So it took about 5 minutes for him to actually come back to me and shake my hand after that match.
What were you doing better than kids 3-4 years older than you?
I think, again, I was just really consistent. You know, every time for me, it was like, you know, hitting the ball gave me such great feeling, and just competing and wanting to win. just kind of came natural. I think you could also tell that when it didn't go so well, which obviously there were days like that as well, you could always, you know, see a certain side of mine as well, where, you know, I would kind of, you know, lose it and yell and not be happy and probably threw my racket here and there and just trying or waiting to get my next chance, my next opportunity, wait for the next day to do better. And that was sort of, I think, the mindset that I had.
So do you remember when you lost matches 6, 7, 8 years old and got very angry? Did you actually learn something? Did you process this experience in a way that made you a better player?
I mean, going back quite some time, I'm sure subconsciously back in the day, I probably would have learned something from it. You know, my older sister played quite good tennis as well as a junior. She was 3 years older than me. And so when my dad put us up against each other, you know, I would always try to find a way how I can, you know, at some point beat her. And she knew, obviously, you know, her ways of how to get to me mentally, because that seemed to be my weakness in my younger years, maybe still in the beginning of my career as well. And she would always find a way, or maybe would say something that would trigger me.
What were the ways of getting to you mentally?
And playing slow, you know, taking her time and, you know, saying certain things if she wins a point or if I make a, you know, easy mistake. And
how did you overcome that? How did you make her not able to get to you?
By beating her at some point, yeah. But it took some time, unfortunately. Same with my dad. It took some time to be better than my dad as well. So that was always, you know, those were always like my main goals at the time. And, you know, other junior tournaments that I played, it seemed to not affect me as much.
Now, you won a national title at the age of about 9, which earned you the chance to spend a couple of weeks at the Bolotteri Academy in Florida, and yet you didn't enjoy it.
That's right. I was 11, actually. I won the German championships under the age of 12, as a year younger, and my sister won it under 14s. So we did win a trip to go to Bolotteri's for 2 weeks back in December 1989. And yeah, I didn't speak much English. Again, you know, it was one of those situations where I thought I was going to be, you know, in a room with my sister, enjoying Florida, playing some tennis, maybe get to meet Nick Bolotteri, etc. But I didn't really know what was going to come my way. And as soon as we arrived, which was the longest trip I've taken at that point, exhausted, they separated us. You know, it was the girl dormitory and the boys. And yeah, as soon as I got to the dormitory, I saw bunk beds and, you know, 7 other students that were 16, 17-year-olds from South America. Again, I couldn't really sort of speak. I'm sure I was very shy. I woke up the next morning. My CD player was stolen. Didn't make me really feel at home at the time when I got there. Food was different. You know, the training was different. So I was actually, yeah, I was homesick right away. Couldn't wait to get back home to Germany.
And yet you ended up at Bolotteri's.
Right. 2 years later, back in 91, a German TV crew wanted to do a story with one of the young up-and-comers from Germany to see what Nick Bolotteri thought of me at the time. And so I think my dad already had sort of like a different vision for me, potentially maybe going there and trying to pursue my goals, my dreams. And was obviously completely different once I got there with my dad. And then actually the rest of the family came after that as well. Met a couple of very, very important people at the time that are like still my brothers today. One of them who spoke German as well. So I felt much more at home. The training was different. Nick Bolotteri took me in right away. So, you know, I was 13, so a little bit more mature. And I knew exactly, obviously, what I wanted to become at that age as well. So I decided to stay.
When did you first get the sense that you wanted to be a tennis player?
Yeah, that was actually when I was 7 years old. You know, Boris Becker won Wimbledon, the youngest Wimbledon champion ever, still to this day, in 1985. And that obviously had an explosion in our country. Tennis became super, super popular. I already played tennis. And so, therefore, it was clear to me at that time that that's what I wanted to do.
But plenty of kids aged 7, 8, 9, 10 have an idea about what they want to do. And it can often change year by year. Yours obviously stuck.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I think playing those tournaments, you know, under 8, under 10s, under 12s, you know, playing the biggest tournaments that we have in Germany that still exist and going there and doing well, I think that helps the cause. You know, I think if you don't necessarily win all the time, or actually if you don't win much, then I think it becomes even tougher and mental side. And then it depends on, you know, how many people are behind your team to kind of keep motivating you, keep telling you that everything is okay. Now, again, I had obviously lots of losses as well as a junior, but I had also lots of wins. So I could kind of balance that out. And always felt like that that this is the path that I wanted to take.
And the fact that you had a bad experience first time at Bolotaris, your determination to be a tennis player, that didn't put you off?
No, that was, you know, 2 years prior. That was in the past. This time I wasn't staying with six, seven other kids in a dormitory that was from South America that were stealing stuff. I got my own sort of little apartment, which became lonely. So I actually, you know, met friends and told them to start staying with me. You know, going to school, obviously, learning another language was a challenge, but I enjoyed it. You know, lots of kids from all around the world, from different countries coming to the academy, trying to do the same. So we all connected really quickly at the same level. And, you know, if it was Anna Kournikova, Eva Maioli, you know, Mark Filippoussis, Marcelo, it doesn't matter. They were all there trying to reach the same goals.
What did Nick Bolotari teach you that was most valuable?
To take my time, to not panic, to have a vision in mind and keep dreaming big. I never got the sense that I needed to prove myself all the time, you know. So, you know, I know he got the sort of the reputation that he was drilling you like crazy, you know, every day was 6-7 hours on a tennis court. And yeah, there were days that were tough and you had to train hard. And of course, in order to reach your goals or your potential, anything you do, you're going to have to put in the hard yards. But, you know, it was never like that. That's all that was that the academy was about. You know, he was smart enough and I think kind enough to take me to lots of tournaments with the likes of, you know, Agassi, Boris Becker when he coached Boris, in order to show me what it's like to be a professional tennis player. And I think those moments obviously motivate you, you know, on a whole nother level on top of the motivation that I already had. So it just kind of, you know, every 6 months, every year, just, you know, you're kind of counting the days until you finish your high school, until you get your high school diploma and turn pro.
We've talked a lot about your motivation, determination. Were there ever any doubts?
I think I doubted myself for the first time when I had shoulder surgery. But before that, no, I never did. I never for a minute thought that I'm not going to turn or become a tennis professional.
So when you look back on a lot of the kids you were at the Bolotari Academy with, who perhaps have not made it anywhere near as successfully as you have, is there anything you can point to the difference? What did you have that they didn't have?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I have still to this day, some of my closest friends, you know, tried to do the same thing and played really only on the Challengers Series Tour for, you know, 10 years. And, you know, highest ranking was only maybe 120, 130 in the world, you know, even though they were tremendous athletes and put probably just as much time into the sport as I did. So what it comes down to maybe in the end sometimes is sort of like in Germany we say, you know, the inner dog, you know, the thrive or the will that you have, you know, just the need to succeed and in order to do everything you can, the competition mindset that you kind of, you know, love being out there, that you take the pressure that you put yourself under, or when you go out in a crowd in front of, you know, thousands of people, that's when you thrive. And maybe it's not for everyone. And you don't really know that until you maybe become a pro and you start playing these tournaments. And if it doesn't go so well in the beginning, you know, maybe you start to think, you know, first of all, it's an expensive sport as well. So you need to have sponsors. You know, if you don't have a sponsor, you look to your family. Maybe your family can help you. Maybe they can. So now you're looking for a handout. And if you start to know all these things, pressure builds. And it's not for everyone, right? And it's a lot of pressure that I think we put ourselves under at times as well. So for me, again, I think turning pro, getting my wild card, my first wild card in 1996 at the tournament in Indianapolis, reaching the quarters off the bat, playing Pete Sampras, you know, like on center court, it's kind of, you know, it's like, wow, it's like you feel like you've arrived. And then, you know, you go to the US Open and you play the qualifying there and you qualify. And I play Michael Stieck on the old grandstand and you lose a tight match 7-5 in the fourth and you feel like, I mean, Sampras, Stieck, I'm playing against these guys. I feel like, you know, if I keep working hard, I can get there, maybe beat them one day. So, you know, it's those kinds of little successes that you need, right, in order to believe it, possibly, and to keep yourself going and to keep it pushing yourself and ultimately, obviously, having a great team of people around you.
And do you have your own theory about how much it's the inner dog and how much natural talent plays a part?
Yeah, I think talent obviously is huge. I think you got to have a love for a game that, you know, that you can just tell, you can just see it. I mean, when I see kids playing now, you know, at age 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you can pretty much pick out one or two of these kids out of 10 that you see, okay, there is just something there. You know, it's just, you know, and I like to count myself into one of those where it's just like, you just enjoy being out there.
But you see the talent rather than the inner dog.
You can see a little bit of both. You know, you can see probably that there's a lot of talent there. And then when it does come down to, you know, trying to win, you can see certain moves of a player, you know, you can see certain habits, and you can just tell like there's something probably there that has a high probability of maybe making it more than some other kids. And that's just, I think, how it works in anything you do.
You mentioned a few of the players who were with you at Bolotaris. You didn't mention Federer, but I think you saw him as a junior, didn't you?
Well, I heard about him. I'm 3 years older than him, so we didn't really play much in the juniors. But, you know, once he won Wimbledon juniors, you know, you kind of always look at it. I mean, I was every turned pro at that time. And again, I was supposed to play him, I think, in his first tournament when he got a wild card into a start in Switzerland. I was supposed to play him first round. I remember that because, I mean, there was a lot of hype about him already. And unfortunately, I couldn't play the match because I had food poison the night before. So, you know, looking back, it's unfortunate because it would have been great to play him in his first ATP match ever. But it didn't happen. But so, you know, you kept an eye on him. And I knew that, I think the first time we played actually was at the Sydney Olympics in 2000. So he was still only 19 at the time, or about to turn 19. And here he is in the semifinals, and, you know, kind of seen him sort of progress and getting better. And, you know, was obviously super nervous in that match. But the funny thing was, before that, I wasn't even quite sure if I was going to go to Sydney Olympics due to another nagging injury. But, you know, everybody told me, listen, you got to go. It's the Olympics. It's your first one that you can participate in. I've always liked going to Australia, played always some good tennis there. And you gotta take that experience with you. And then actually, as I got there, and I kept thinking to myself, wow, imagine you get to the semifinals at the Olympics. Obviously, if you say I got to the semis at the Australian Open, I got to the semis in Vienna, it's like, you know, you take that result as a very positive. But if you lose in the semis at the Olympics, then you actually have to play for the bronze medal. And I kept thinking to myself, God, that would be awful to do that. You know, I think the pressure would just be so extremely high. So when I actually got to the semis, I was so focused and so locked in, because the last thing I wanted to do is play for a bronze medal. And so I played a pretty decent match and got to Federer. This is when he was obviously still not the Federer as we like to think of him. Still a little bit more, you know, impatient, and he got, you know, threw rackets around a little bit. So I got the better of him that day, and which was obviously great for me to, you know, come home with a silver medal.
And what did you have that he didn't at that stage? The 3 years obviously made a difference.
I think probably just a little bit more experience. You know, I was just a little bit more steady during that day, you know, locked in. I mean, I was not always the toughest mentally. Don't get me wrong. There was moments when, you know, I could have been, should have been, but, you know, something would bother me and got the better of me, or at least for maybe a couple of games. And sometimes you can still find a way to win those matches, but against really talented, good people, then it's usually going to haunt you at the end. But at that particular time, I was just, you know, probably, you know, winning the big points better. I was just locked in more.
You had a great year at the end of 2001, start of 2002. You finished 2001 just inside the top 10. 2002, Australian Open semi-final. Final in Rome, world number two. Where were you thinking of your career at that point?
Yeah, I was just thinking at that time, wow, I've sort of, you know, I'm right there where I always, you know, dreamt of being, you know, playing consistent, tough tennis, feeling physically probably better than I have ever at that stage in my career. And the results showed. And obviously super, super proud of the achievements. And, you know, I think at that time, the main goal, as it always was, you know, to try to win a slam. I think that's every kid's dream growing up playing tennis. Wimbledon was, you know, actually it was the French Open first, but Wimbledon was just around the corner. Didn't really always think or believe that I could win the French with my style of play at the time, even though I've had some good results on clay as well throughout my career. But I thought Wimbledon or US Open would be more likely for it to happen. And so, yeah, I was just really proud. You know, I think end of 2001, I really had major talks with myself. I wasn't really playing, I think, up to my potential. I think I was, you know, complaining a little bit too much about certain things. And I just kind of found a way to be more mature, take nothing for granted, and really lock in more, and then the results showed, and I think that was the way.
How did you find a way, if you were sort of undermining yourself by complaining? Was there a sort of mental trick that you played on yourself? Was there a work with a psychologist or what?
Yeah, I never really worked with a psychologist in that situation, but growing up at the Bali Terry Tennis Academy, there was always people around doing different things, if it was trying to find the next level, and so there were actually a lot of people around that were sports psychologists. I just never really found myself working with them really long, but that would maybe put together some highlights or some situations, that videos where you see yourself, and you see yourself how you act, and it's not always the proudest moment, and then you have the conversation with your team where maybe you didn't put all of 100% into a match, and that we gotta try to maybe be more aware of that and start doing that, and in tennis the match is never over until the last point is played. But sometimes when you're down maybe 6-2, 3-0, you already feel like you're out of it, but maybe you're not. And if you have that belief and that mindset all the time, which, by the way, I admire, players like that can just shut off the score and not worry about it. And obviously some of the players, or the players that I'm talking about, are some of the greatest of all time, because they had that attribute that maybe I didn't have until later in my career. And that's something, again, that's as well a talent, And so if you look at the talent side of all the talents that you should have or need to have in order to become a champion, that's one maybe that took me a little bit longer to realize and learn.
When one looks at your career, the curve up went until about May, June 2002. And then two things happened. Your shoulder problems that were around for a few months got bad, and your parents were involved in a fairly serious motorcycle crash. Both of them affected you. To what extent was the rest of your career a case of consistent comeback trail?
Yeah, as you mentioned, end of 2001, and up until that point, things were going really, really well, statistically, and, having success, winning some tournaments, career high, lots of new firsts for me, which was obviously amazing. But I already started beginning of 2002 having some weird shoulder injury or feelings in my shoulder that I couldn't quite explain. And, you start going to doctors, you do the MRIs, you do the whole thing every time, and try to figure out, okay, how can I get rid of this nagging pain that sometimes, arrives and gives me super, super huge problems, and couldn't really serve, couldn't really hit a high forehand the way I wanted to. And then it would kind of come and go as well. So, some of the team members, I would say, started maybe questioning if it's just in the head, which obviously I took too hard, because, I can endure some pain. And, the last thing I want to do at the high of my career is to sort of, have to answer to that, because, anyone that knows me, once you go out there, you compete and you deal with the things that you have, and that's it. But not having played Halle in Germany that year, for a German, is obviously also very unusual. It's one of those tournaments, that led up to Wimbledon, that was a must for a German player to play. And I had high hopes, to do well there as well. Always wanted to win that tournament, being that it's on grass in Germany. But I decided, because of my shoulder, not to play that year, which obviously should have shown everyone that the shoulder injury is real. Went back to Florida to try to get some treatment, give it some rest. I was hoping to be seeded either 2 or 3 in Wimbledon with a bit of a good draw. Who knows, maybe I could get into the second week, and then anything is possible at this stage of my career. But then my parents had a bad motorcycle accident, yes. And I was actually coming from St. Petersburg from some shoulder treatment. And my girlfriend at the time called me hysterically, saying that she just drove by coincidentally and saw my parents laying on the street and not moving, and that they were in a bad motorcycle crash. So I was actually at the hospital already before my parents were flown there by helicopter. So this is sort of like all of a sudden when tennis doesn't really play a role anymore in my life at that time. The shoulder was sort of, who cares? This is when, family got together, and I was just kind of, trying to see in what situation position my parents are in. My mom was very lucky, obviously took a lot of injuries as well, but my dad was in a in a coma for about 3 weeks at the time. They didn't know if they could possibly save his leg. That was the first thing. So I tried to, you know, I was having these conversations with the doctors, you know, coming in and out of the surgery. And I kept telling the doctor, like, you know, whatever you need to do. My dad loves life and is very athletic. Try to save that leg with everything you can. And sure enough, he was able to, which was great. But tennis wasn't really around for the next couple of weeks. You know, my sisters came to Florida, obviously, to see the situation and be there for my parents. And so I decided not to play Wimbledon, which is still a discussion in our household to this day. Because I think if my dad would have been awake, he would have said, listen, you know, you're going to play Wimbledon no matter what. But in this case, I decided not to.
You said tennis wasn't a factor for a few weeks. I mean, did it change you, that accident, even putting all the injuries aside? Did it change you to the point where you were never quite the same tennis player in your head again?
I don't think this situation had anything to do with me being the same tennis player. I think I probably became a better tennis player even with years afterwards, right? Even with all these injuries that I, you know, I kept trying to improve. And you had to improve because everybody else was improving. And if you wanted to beat the top players of the world, that's what you had to do. And obviously, your dreams never die until, you know, you're no longer a professional tennis player. So you keep going after your goals and dreams and do what you need to do. But I think it definitely shook me in my regular life much, much more, right? I mean, I could have lost my parents there and then at that time. And you realize, wow, life is short. You know, you got to appreciate every day. And I'm very grateful that my parents are still here to this day. Try to spend as much time with them as I can, which, you know, doesn't happen a lot. I think from my parents' point of view, they're probably much more sad about it than I am. You know, having my own family now and living in California most of the time, it's, you know, for my parents, probably a tough thing knowing that their son left pretty much when he was at a young age. And even after his tennis career, he's still, you know, living a different life in a different country. So, yeah, it's a situation that happened where you realize, be thankful for everything you have. You know, it can be taken away from you quickly. And I think that also helped me in some ways to realize, you know, a shoulder surgery or two or maybe three mean nothing when you kind of know that it can be much worse.
I mean, from the first shoulder surgery, the end of 2002, to the end of your career, it was 15 years. And you had three more shoulder operations and a hip operation.
Yeah.
And various other things.
Yeah.
There must have been moments when you thought, this isn't worth it. What kept you going?
You know, it is worth it, to the bottom line. You know, it's like when I was about 32 almost, I think, or turning 32, I had, you know, a labrum tear in my hip. It took me some time to figure out that it was actually a labrum tear in my hip because my knee gave out first and my lower back, etc. So when I knew I had to do surgery there and I knew that the recovery is going to be another year, you know, at that age, I was kind of thinking, maybe this is it. You know, some of my idols stopped playing tennis at, you know, 31, 32, 33 is sort of like the time, you know, except Agassi kind of showed us the way still at 36. Obviously, Jimmy Connors, which wasn't in my time, played longer as well and was very successful still. Obviously, one of the greatest of all time. So anyway, I just felt like, okay, maybe this is it. But then shortly after, I found out I was going to become a dad. So then you kind of find, you know, new motivation and you say to yourself, you know what, let me just try to see if I can get back in shape and go out there again and have another comeback. You know, why not? I feel physically fit. I feel mentally still very stable and wanting to do, you know, to play and to grind and to get back into shape to go back out there. Because I think anytime you go on a stadium court and you're playing a match and, you know, people are kind enough to come and fill those seats, I mean, it doesn't get much better. You know, when you're a young kid thinking about those moments, you know, looking back and, you know, me being a spectator now and being behind the scenes in tennis a little bit and, you know, being a fan of the sport and going out there myself and going to watch the next generation or still the current legends, you know, it's great. And I know the feeling when you go out there, you know, the nerves and the pressure you put yourself under and wanting to win. And then you have these points, you know, where the crowd goes crazy. It's special. It's something that in all sports, you know, all athletes, that's really ultimately what we miss. Do I miss the grind? Do I miss, you know, going out there and doing, you know, sprints and being, you know, completely packed a full day of just, you know, recovery, massaging, stretching, you know, physical work, you know, on-court work. I don't miss those days all the time. You know, those are hard, tough days and they're grueling on your body and grueling mentally and you can't really, you know, enjoy family much or, you know, you pass, you know, out on things that, you know, you might not go to that concert or you might not go on that trip because, you know, you feel guilty if you're not training. So now that you have the chance to do more of those things and travel and see the world and with a different set of eyes and go to these events still and be a part of it and just kind of look at it from an outside point of view, it's a lot of fun.
So can you compare achievements as a player? I mean, where does getting to number two in the world or winning an Olympic silver medal compare with the comebacks that you made, beating Federer in that 2017 when he was winning everything and you beat him on grass? I mean, are some of the comebacks greater achievements for you than the obvious statistical achievements?
In some ways, yeah. Looking back, you know, if you were to pat your own shoulder and, you know, and say, hey, that was pretty impressive. You know, I think you really only look back at your career as you sort of have hung up the racket and, you know, announced that you're retired. And then, you know, some fans or people will come up to you every once in a while and say, you know, congrats on a great career. And you kind of look back and you have time over time to kind of think about certain situations, you know, certain things you forget, you know, as you kind of, you know, are away from the game longer and longer. Some things come back sometimes, you know, when you go back on, in this case here in New York, Arthur Ashe Stadium, you know, I remember I had one of my best shots that I ever hit in my career back in 1999. I don't know if it was a first round or second round, but I hit a tweener against Isha Marazi, which was an insane shot. So, you know, you look back on those moments and not necessarily always like, you know, oh, I won this title. It's more like moments like, oh, I remember winning this match, or, oh, I can't believe I lost that match. Oh, I remember I had an amazing rally here. But to answer your question, yeah, I think it's those achievements, you know, coming back from injuries, when people doubted you, you're probably not going to come back, or you're not going to be able to play or beat maybe some of the top players anymore. That makes me happy, yeah.
What gave you the greatest pleasure as a player? What is there a moment in your life where you thought, gosh, I've really enjoyed this?
Well, I think, you know, because it's an individual sport and a selfish sport, and, you know, you're only really going to be really remembered if you win a slam, which is the truth, makes it difficult to really say what I enjoyed the most. But of course, I mean, looking up, or, you know, having the chance to know Andre Agassi since I was very young, you know, remembering when he won Wimbledon in 1992 against Goran Ivanišević, you know, his first slam, which was sort of, he probably should have won the French a couple of years before that. Then having a chance to play him on center court, you know, 6 years later in 1998 in Wimbledon, my first time walking on that court after knowing all the history with Boris and Andre, you know, and going out there and beating him. It's one of those moments where you say, I don't care what Andre says, if he had a bad day or not. I shook his hand as a winner that day. So that's one of those moments where you look back and you go, that was a very, very proud moment. And that's special. Or, you know, like we talked about before, you know, winning my last match on grass against Roger when he just kind of, you know, came off winning the Australian Open that year, became number one again. And actually a few weeks later, won Wimbledon again. So it's like, that was a special moment. But again, you know, I think selfishly, you always look at what could have been, you know, in a way. But at the same time, it's also nice to say it could have been a lot worse.
With 2020 hindsight, would you have done anything different?
I think I would do it all over again. I mean, maybe I wish I was a little bit more mature at times, or I knew a few things earlier than later, to maybe change a few things, maybe be more playful at times also during practices and try more things. I feel like now I have 8 or 9 different forehand grips in my repertoire than, you know, maybe only 2 while I was a professional player.
Were you too serious?
Yeah, maybe, you know, you just kind of, you follow a certain, you know, protocol and, you know, work on not the same things, I would say, but you kind of have your game style. And, you know, I think I wish I would have been more experimental. You know, I think even for me, I felt like on clay for the longest time, I felt like if I would go way behind the baseline and let the ball drop and then hit the return, kind of like a Medvedev does now or Dominic Thiem does now, I always felt comfortable doing that. And I did it at times anyway, but, you know, I felt like a lot of people were saying, like, you can't stand that far behind the baseline. And nobody does it. It's not good. It's not going to help you for your game style. And now I look at, you know, how some of the guys are playing, and it's working pretty good for them. So I feel like I should have done that maybe a little bit more, or, you know, or play with my own inner feeling more than always discussing it and how you can play. But there's so many different ways now as well, right? The game has changed so much too, where everything, you know, you have eyes everywhere, you know, you have the statistics everywhere. You can look at it, you know, every day on your iPhone if you wanted to. So back in the mid-90s, late-90s, when I was playing, my parents had to, you know, look at the newspaper and see if I won, you know, the next day or not. So that so it has evolved and has changed. So maybe if I was born in this era, it would have been a lot different.
As a player, it's all about you within your team. You're now a tournament director, where you have to deal with a lot of players, with a lot of egos, a lot of agents. How has the transition been?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, obviously. I mean, I'm very, very blessed and lucky to be part of such an amazing event that we call the Fifth Slam. We have an amazing owner who has done amazing things with the tournament over the years, an amazing team of people that have started it many, many years ago that are still there. So it's been a great learning process. You know, I'm happy to be another set of eyes to keep making sure that the tournament heads in the right direction, that we are always evolving. And that, you know, I call it the three, that the three most important factors are happy, right? Number one is the fans. I mean, sorry, number one is the players. Without the players, nobody would come. The fans wouldn't come. So that's huge that we make sure that they feel great, that everything is taken care of, how we can improve there. And I think we've done an amazing job being voted 9 years in a row now. Best, you know, Masters 1000 on the ATP and WTA side, which is an incredible achievement. And then the fans, you know, I love going around the grounds, doing the tournament, and talking to people, see what they say, what they like, what they don't like. Lucky for us that there's not many things that they don't like, but there's still always room for improvement. So, you know, you can never really take your eyes off the ball.
You said there were three things: players, fans,
and obviously the sponsors,
okay.
Because they make it possible. And that keeps helping us, you know, growing the sport in the right direction. Trying to break records, you know, is obviously always a goal, getting more spectators and making sure they're all taken care of and having a good time. That's really what it's all about.
If you have to give advice to youngsters trying to make their way in tennis or the parents of youngsters, what are you most comfortable telling them?
Oof, that's a good one. Well, number one, obviously, if I would see them play, you know, is obviously to be super, super joyful and really loving going out there. You know, I think that's important. You know, I think that makes life a lot easier, right? That the parents are not too pushy and sort of have a dream for their child. I'm a father now myself. You know, I wish my kids would play more tennis, but without the intention of necessarily wanting them to go pro, but just because it's a great sport, you can play it for life. It opens up maybe some doors down the road. And, you know, selfishly, I want to play tennis with my kids, you know, if we go on vacations down the road, because it's just fun. You know, you move around. It's the best sport for longevity, by the way, as well, right? Racket sports, tennis is up there. So that's obviously good news as well. But just to kind of, you know, be patient with yourself, enjoy it, enjoy the ride. Parents, make sure that, you know, you support them the best you can. Be patient also with yourself on that end. Try to find, you know, good coaches and be positive and just enjoy it.
Tommy Haas, I wish you a lot of fun and thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and memories with us.
Thank you.
What wonderful honesty there from Tommy Haas, admitting that he wished he'd been a bit more playful in his practices and a little less serious overall. Tommy was talking there with Chris Bowers. If you enjoyed the interview, please tell other tennis fans you know where they can find it, basically by searching for Tennis Worthy Podcast on their preferred podcast platform or through tennisfame.com/podcast. And if you've missed any other interviews, they're all there on the website. Next time, we're going to go back to the breakout days of women's tennis in the late 1960s and early 70s, and we have a bit of a doubleheader for you. We'll be speaking with the Australian Judy Dalton and the American Rosie Casals, both members of the legendary Original Nine, the group of female players who challenged the massive discrepancy between what women were earning in pro tennis compared with the men, and who as a group are now members of the Hall of Fame. The Tennis Worthy Podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to tell your friends about these interviews. We look forward to seeing you next time.